We're now joined in the studio by Judith Levine, author of the book Harmful to Minors, The Perils of Protecting Children from Sex. And this is just published by the University of Minnesota Press. And I think the publication itself is a story, isn't it? Didn't start looking for a university publisher, right?
No, I didn't. The book was originally bought by a commercial press. The book says that kids can have pleasure and also sexual pleasure and also be safe, which turned out to be an even more radical statement than I thought it was going to be. So many commercial presses turned it down. And then finally, my editor was fired, not because of my book. It went to many other presses and finally made its way to the University of Minnesota. After it had gone through many, many different iterations, it became something of an advice book, which I never wanted it to be. But I'm happy where I ended up.
Well, you know, I don't see a pitchfork, or I don't smell any sulfurous odors. But you've been demonized as an agent of the devil for having written this book.
I have been. I've been called evil by Robert Knight of the Concerned Women for America, which is an organization.
Is he a concerned woman too?
Right. It's amazing that out of 350,000 alleged members, they can't find a woman to speak for them. But Robert Knight, the Concerned Women for America, even though it sounds like the League of Women Voters, is actually a conservative Christian organization. That in addition to attacking my book and every other book about sexuality, all sex education and sex research, it's also trying to stop teaching of evolution in the schools and other evil things. And Robert Knight called my book an evil tome, and then he called me evil. And when that wasn't enough, he said I was very evil.
Well, you don't look very evil to me. But you said pleasure was a problem. I think you quoted a rather liberal and, what you thought, enlightened editor who just got nervous about the use of the word pleasure. Right?
Yeah, it seems that talking about sexual pleasure, by which I don't mean just having sexual intercourse, but masturbating or playing doctor or touching other people or kissing or fantasizing or talking. People are very, very worried about the dangers that are associated with sex, and those are legitimate worries, like unwanted pregnancies and HIV and those kind of things. We can talk about that later. But the idea that kids have a right not only to safety and information, but also to pleasure and to sexual privacy seems to be really anathema in this country.
And you say in this country. Is there anything like this anywhere else in the world that you know of?
Afghanistan under the Taliban. In Europe, they have a much different attitude, in Western Europe at least, toward kids' sexuality. The assumption is that teenagers will have sexual relationships and that kids younger than their teens will enter into different, will have other kinds of sexual and bodily pleasures. And in order to deal with that, what they do is they start very early with sexuality education in the public schools, and also kids can access reproductive health services, including abortions, like they can get all kinds of health services for free. Condoms are widely available in every drugstore and every vending machine. And in general, kids are not protected from what adults here would think are harmful images. For instance, there are no signs in galleries that say the pictures in this gallery may be offensive to adults or harmful to minors. The notion is that kids will grow into their sexuality and they'll live sort of side by side with adults around sexual images and literature and talk and jokes and plays and everything else.
But you mentioned the Taliban in Afghanistan, but you know, this is also a country where Viagra pitchman Bob Dole does a sort of salacious ad looking at Britney Spears. I mean, we were also saturated with sexual imagery, unlike the Taliban. How do you reconcile this?
Well, actually, even in the Taliban, I remember the first day after the women took off the burqa, there was pictures on the front page of the Times of the liberation of Kabul, and there were the women taking off their veils, and the picture right next to it were men looking at pictures of rock stars and film stars sort of nearly naked. So I think in almost every culture, sexual imagery and advertising and all that other stuff coexists with sort of sensorial and anxious feelings and policies. every single generation is always worried about the corrupting media that their kids are looking at. So,
oh, there's one amazing query. It's not just conservatives either. This Neil Postman. This is beautiful. The liberal educator Neil Postman dated the disappearance of childhood to the invention of the telegraph in the mid-1800s, which eventually spurred a mass media that availed all people of all ages of all sexual secrets. And without secrets, he wrote, there is no such thing as childhood. And this is not a member of the Concerned Women of America.
No, not at all. And I think he's right, though, about that, that in every single era since the idea that childhood is innocent of and ignorant of sexuality is a relatively recent idea historically. It's only been around for 150 or 200 years. And before that, kids, young people, people before pubescence and even after it, lived side by side with adults. They worked, they were soldiers, they got married, they had children, and they availed themselves of all of the media of their day, which could have been, you know, plays in the town square or bawdy songs in the pub. And that's true again, because the media are so pervasive, and there is no way of segregating audiences by age anymore. And I think that's really at the bottom of a lot of people's anxieties about kids knowing too many things about sex, and if they know them, the fear is that they're going to go out and do whatever they see.
I'm speaking with Judith Levine, author of Harmful to Minors, just published by University of Minnesota Press. And has a foreword by Jocelyn Elders, who herself got in a little trouble.
She did. Jocelyn Elders was the first Surgeon General in the Clinton administration who made the faux pas at a gathering of sex educators, as a matter of fact, when asked whether masturbation would be an appropriate subject for discussion in a sex ed classroom. She said, yes, of course it was. The conservatives in Congress didn't like this, and within short order, they called on the president to fire her, and he did.
Of course.
He didn't exactly stand up for his radicals. But Jocelyn Elders was also a thorn in the right side for many other reasons. She believed in a rational drug policy. She was really against the drug war. And in general, she believes that young people have rights to sex, to citizenship, really, and that they shouldn't be treated as they shouldn't be restricted in order to protect them, although she is a great child welfare advocate. And that was the reason we wanted her to preface my book, because I think I look at this sexuality in the context of all kinds of child welfare. It's hypocritical for us to be trying to protect kids from sexual dangers when we don't seem to care whether their mothers are homeless or whether they have good food in their bellies. And as a matter of fact, poverty is the greatest correlate with all kinds of negative outcomes about sex. 80% of teen mothers are from poor families. One-third of black gay youth are HIV positive. And even sexual abuse is correlated with poverty, so that if you are a child in a family that earns less than $15,000 a year, you're 18 times more likely to be sexually abused than if you come from a family that's middle class. And that's not because poor people are depraved. It's because they have stresses in their lives. They may have drug and alcohol problems. They may have unstable and crowded housing, poor education, and so on.
Over the last 20 or 30 years, we've seen growing tolerance in this country for sexual minorities of all sorts, a growing acknowledgement of the sexual autonomy of women, although we've got a long way to go. But at the same time, we've seen this growing hysteria about child sex and child sex abuse and all this madness about, this is mostly the 80s, all the daycare scandals, satanic ritual abuse stories. But why do we have these things happening together?
Well, they're related. The right has reacted against the very same people who are attacking me also have a well-built-up agenda against abortion, against homosexuality. They're trying to cure homosexuals. That's the latest chapter in their campaign. They do believe that that all kinds of sexuality outside of heterosexual marriage is wrong, according to their interpretation of the Christian Bible, and that the more of this stuff there is out there, the more our culture is sort of falling apart, going to hell in a handbasket. And so child sexuality, I think, is sort of the last queer sex. It's the last it's the last, they're the last innocents to protect. But, you know, it's not just the right that's worried about this. Feminists also come at this from a protectionist standpoint. And what I mean from that by that is that there was a really, really important revelation of feminism in the 1970s, and that was that the family was not a safe and harmonious place necessarily for every woman or every child, that incest was real, that it was not just a fantasy of little girls wanting to have sex with their fathers. And what happened to that revelation was that psychologists began to develop practices that were really based around the idea that everybody who had sex with an adult in childhood would necessarily have some sort of psychological pathology when they grew up, or if they had a patient who came in and was anxious or depressed or had some other problem, say a sexual problem, you could find sexual abuse in that person's past, even if she didn't remember it. And so soon you had organizations and journals and clinics.
If you denied it, you're in denial. Right?
That's right. If you deny it, you're in denial, and then they would do recovered memory where they would do hypnosis to try to suggest to you that even though you didn't remember this, couldn't have this have happened and that have happened. And that was where the daycare abuse scandals came from, and where there seemed to be all of a sudden a huge, huge incidence of child abuse. I think we've started to come back a little bit from that. But both the right and the left are worried, I think, that they tend to see child sexuality as something that is imposed upon children by adults, either by propaganda, that is, by advertising in the media, or because adults are literally forcing kids to have sex. Now, I'm not a big believer in nature. I don't believe that, you know, sex is always the same throughout history and everybody has these drives and no matter what culture you live in, they're going to feel the same and be the same. Nevertheless, kids around the world and throughout history have seemed to have sexual desire and to act upon it. So the idea that this is somehow being foisted upon them by adults, I think, is a misconception.
Well, of course, Sigmund Freud, 100 years ago, earned a permanent spot in the axis of evil for saying
right,
that
that's right.
Children had sexual
that's right.
impulses.
And not only Freud, but everybody subsequently who's done any sex research. Kinsey is a huge, I mean, if you think I'm evil in their eyes, Alfred Kinsey, who was the first person who did behavioral research and went out and asked people, what do you do? Well, it turned out that about 10% of people had some homosexual desire. It turned out that everybody was masturbating. And the way that the right reacted to that was to say that what he was doing was normalizing what they considered to be deviant behavior. And they think that if I talk about child sexuality or minor adult sex, that because I'm reporting on the existence of these things, I am promoting or trying to normalize what they consider to be deviant and evil behaviors.
Well, you also make the point that a lot of this historical discourse pathologize what's really normative childhood sexual behavior. Can you talk about what you mean by
yeah,
that?
Normative is more of a statistical term than normal. Normal turns out to be sort of a moral term. Normative is what most people do. Sociologists use it to mean also what most people think you should do. But there, in addition to this, as a sort of outgrowth of this idea that everybody was abused, there began to be about 10 years ago a new subspecialty of abuse therapists who were looking at little children who were, say, playing with each other in the bathtub, whether this was, you know, brothers and sisters or little friends in nursery school. They were touching and poking little things into their orifices and so on.
I mean, when I was playing doctor,
right.
it was just a
right.
kind of a joke, but now it's like an occasion for a professional intervention.
Right, doing what even 10 or 15 years earlier every child psychologist would say, don't worry about it, that's just how kids are. Suddenly these children, especially if they were like a year older than the other child, were being charged as molesters, as pedophiles, even if they themselves were children. And without any data whatsoever, we know very, very little about normative child sexual behaviors. Another little subspecialty began to form itself, its own organizations, its own journals, around what they called sexual behavior problems of children. And they began to not only pathologize, but treat with also all kinds of quite punitive and, I think, frightening, sort of trying to strip kids' fantasies away and treat them like sex offenders for doing the kinds of things that anthropologists have observed throughout the world in every culture. In fact, it's so common that kids will play at sex, that anthropologists have a term for it. They call it sexual rehearsal play. So these psychologists in America were saying, for instance, if a little boy gets on top of a little girl and mimes intercourse, that child must have been abused himself. Something terrible must have happened to him, and now he's trying to do this to this other person, and she will herself be traumatized, and she may pass on this trauma to someone else.
Now, but what kind of sensibility is it that would see that as something terrible?
Anyway, filthy minds. I really do sometimes think these people have really perverse fantasies themselves. In fact, somebody who did some research on pedophilia said that some journalist on the radio was saying to him, and what if a 45-year-old man was putting a cigar in your 12-year-old daughter's vagina? You know, like, as long as you talk about it in a negative light, it's okay to talk about everything. I mean, this is what Foucault said. He said, we talk about sex all the time, but we talk about it inside of, you know, these discourses around criminalization or around disease or around disorder. As long as we say this is terrible and sick, we can fantasize out loud all we want to.
the Mies Commission report on pornography was full of period material.
Oh, absolutely.
Bought it at the government printing office.
Great one-hand reading.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, the classic image of, you know, child sexual abuse would be, you know, like a middle-aged guy waiting around the corner to lure some 9-year-old and do terrible, unspeakable things to him or her. Is that a fair representation of what really goes on?
No, it's not. Most sexual abuse happens to children inside their own families. The least of it is it's actually not often fathers, but uncles or the boyfriends of their mothers or other men who live in their families with them. Stranger abuse is relatively rare. The pedophile priest, for instance, is a pretty rare creature. So I ask in my book, so why are we so worried about him if what's really going on is that kids are more in danger in their families? Well, certainly for the family.
Of course. Everybody should buy the book to find the answer. But well, what is the answer?
Well, the family values crowd, of course, would say that the family is a safe place. But for everyone else, I actually do think that parents have very many legitimate reasons to fear for their children in this big world. We have dismantled every single public institution that would help kids to be safe and help families to raise their kids comfortably. For instance, good child care. There's no health care. Housing is too expensive. And so kids move out into the world and families move out into the world without anything but the marketplace to help them. So we have this kind of general, I think, social anxiety about kids in danger in the world. In this country and in the West, we tend to sexualize those anxieties. And so the child molester, in many periods of history, including our own, has arisen as a kind of symbolic boogeyman. The same thing happened during industrialization when young people were going out and working in factories. They were facing both exploitation and also a fair measure of freedom. Right now, I think, again, with the media, that's happening again, that kids are in danger of exploitation, and they also have a lot more freedom than maybe one generation ago.
Speak with Judith Levine, author of Harmful to Minors, just published by University of Minnesota Press. And as your book was coming out, so was the great priest scandal. I don't know, has it been helpful to your publicity work or not?
Who knows? Everything can be spun.
Yeah. But I mean, what are your thoughts on what's going on now? Why has it been happening and why the reaction to it? Why now?
I'm not quite sure why now. There were similar revelations made in the late 80s, and there wasn't quite the big to-do as there is right now. The general lesson I would draw from all of this stuff is that sexuality always happens inside a culture. As I said before, it's not natural. It's not the same in every culture and in every period of history. So if you wanted to do a study about what would happen to adult and child sexuality and their relationship in a culture that was rigidly enforcing sexual ignorance, intolerance, and secrecy, and also, I think this is important, that required absolute obedience to authority by children, you would get the Catholic Church. Now, you couldn't do that study because it would be unethical. But what you have is you have adults who are needing to sort of squeeze their sexuality into places where they can keep it secret, and that is by having it with kids who are not going to talk. And then also kids who have been taught that this person is not only an authority figure, he represents God himself. And so it's very hard for a child to say no. Now, it's hard for us to know now who's doing what to whom. As I read these stories, you have there was just one that I just read about today, a guy who started out having a relationship with a priest when he was 14, and this went on past the guy's graduation from seminary. Now the guy is married, he's got four kids, and he has trouble sleeping, he feels a lot of anxiety, and he has attributed his current problems to this relationship that ended quite badly with this priest. He feels like the priest forced himself on him. Now, I'm not saying that that was not a heartbreaking or even a traumatic experience for this man, but people interpret their current lives and troubles, they interpret their past in the light of everything that's happened since then, and also in the light of history. We now place a lot of importance on sexual experiences in childhood, and so people will go to a therapist and they will pull out the sexual experience as the traumatic moment. I think it's a real oversimplification of the etiology of psychological, unhappiness in adulthood. For instance, other kinds of neglect and abuse in childhood are shown to be much, much more harmful in a much longer-term way. So now you have a lot of people who feel screwed up for some reason, and they remember this thing happened to them with a priest, and so they're coming forward. And I think, an award of $400,000 or so,
doesn't hurt either. But, I mean, one of the things that's gotten you in trouble for this book is saying that teenagers, even early teenagers, have agency and sometimes get positive things out of relations with older people.
Well, it turns out that the majority of heterosexual teenage girls have their first sexual experiences with somebody who is 1, 2, 3 years older than them. And I think that's probably true of gay boys. And about 10% of heterosexual girls and probably gay boys have a lover, first lover, who's 5 years older than them or more. You talk to any gay man, this is really a part of gay culture. I think it's partly because you can't be out in high school. There aren't as many people to choose from. And so relationships between adult men and teenage boys is pretty common. If it were always harmful, I think we would see a lot more screwed up kids. I don't think that necessarily an age difference constitutes a power difference. It can. And the bigger difference between ages, the more power difference there obviously is. But most so-called intergenerational or minor adult sex happens between, say, a 17-year-old and a 22- or 23-year-old. Can it be heartbreaking? Yes. But it's a relationship between you and your peer. I would rather
not the education for legal or medical right. intervention necessarily.
To me, criminalization of such relationships is not achieving the intended effect, which would be to protect kids from sexual exploitation. There are many other things that we can do: educate them, really treat them as responsible people, and hold them true to their responsibilities. We infantilize our kids in this country as at the same time as we kind of neglect their basic needs.
I'm afraid we have to end it there. thank you for joining us, Judith Levine, author of a brave and important book, Harmful to Minors, just published by University of Minnesota Press. Another reminder.